In 1993, Michael Ignatieff made a documentary series called Blood and Belonging. It focused on the destructive nature of ethnic nationalism. In one scene, Ignatieff visits a small town in the former Yugoslavia. It's been devastated by civil war. Ignatieff mournfully comments, "This is the landscape of ethnic cleansing." A little later, he visits Vukovar. Surveying the wreckage, he states that the entire city should be made into a heritage site of ethnic nationalism. Shift to 2009. Ignatieff is now a liberal leader. In Gaza, there are scenes of carnage and destruction. There's ethnic cleansing. And Ignatieff unconditionally sides with Israel, the aggressors. One wonders why the change, why the reluctance to employ the standards he used for the Balkan conflict. Derek O'Keefe has joined me in the studio to discuss Michael Ignatieff. Derek is editor of rabble.ca, and he is the co-chair of stopwar.ca. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning.
Michael Ignatieff made a show of being a human rights advocate. Why then has he supported Israel in its indiscriminate violence in Gaza?
Well, it has to do with political power, and ultimately it has to do with Michael Ignatieff's total identification with political and military power, and as expressed in his writings and his speaking engagements over the years in which he is an explicit advocate of empire. So, for instance, in 2003, just before his infamous support of the Iraq War, he wrote a book called Empire Light. And in that book, it's very interesting. Reading Michael Ignatieff is sort of like reading a compass. I was thinking about it with the magnetic north being political power. The needle kind of bobbles around a bit. And reading Ignatieff, you do get a sense that he grasps reality. He sees different sides to a conflict, but ultimately, when the push comes to shove, he sides with those in power. So I could just read a brief quote about Palestine, for instance, from his book Empire Light. We can see that he does understand the fundamental issues at play. It's just that he chooses to side with the occupier, and he chooses to side now as liberal leader with the people he views as most important to win the backing financially and politically for his aspirations to be prime minister. So in Empire Light, Ignatieff writes, "America is hated both because it is Israel's mainstay and because even when it supports Palestinian statehood, it gives them no more than a Bantustan. The Palestinian Authority was divided by roads and settlements, split into the West Bank and Gaza, and incapable of effective self-rule and development." And he goes on to speak of the illegal settlements and an unjust occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So it's very clear that he understands the core issues there. He's just siding with the powerful. He's siding with Israel.
What does he mean by the title of that book, Empire Light?
Empire Light. Empire Light is Michael Ignatieff's contribution to rebranding imperialism. He is advocating imperialism, but what he's doing in this book is claiming that today's empire, the American empire, is a different beast to the old European colonial and imperial projects, in that America does not directly administer the colonies, and so forth, and he argues that it's a more humanitarian project. It's not an original idea to argue that imperialism is being done for humanitarian reasons and for other altruistic motives, but Ignatieff in this book and in other writings seems to present it as a new idea. In the New York Times New York Times Magazine, January 2003, we find Ignatieff at his most glowing in describing Empire Light as a global hegemony whose grace notes are money, free markets, human rights, and democracy, enforced by the most awesome military power the world has ever known.
Wow. Amazing.
He's impressed. He's impressed. And you get it with his work in the 1990s as a foreign correspondent in the Balkans, covering the imperial wars there, particularly in Kosovo. It's almost like reading Robert Kaplan, who is an American neoconservative known as America's Kipling, very much focused on the fact that he's there with the men in the trenches. It's a very patriarchal image of the garrisons abroad. And in the book Empire Light, he actually refers to controlling the frontier zones of the empire where the barbarians live. He uses the words barbarian. He's unabashed in making the analogy with Rome. So he's very much admiring and of the awesome military power of Empire.
Now, you mentioned his support of the war in Iraq. What was his rationale for that?
His rationale, well, he not only bought the Bush rationale of weapons of mass destruction, but he pushed that in very influential publications, repeating legitimizing the notion of preemptive war in the case of Iraq, repeating the lies about weapons of mass destruction, which, as we know, there was no evidence for. The Bush rationale sort of, the goalposts kept moving, and that, you know, then it became about removing Saddam, then it became about promoting democracy and so forth. Ignatieff was using all of those rationales for the beginning. He was claiming that it was a humanitarian intervention from the beginning. So although he was also going along with the weapons of mass destruction, he was looking at it through his own rose-colored glasses. And even in his recanting of his support for the Iraq war, there's no acknowledgement of the fundamental issues at play, which is that the war was illegal, that the United States had no right to go in and change regimes and occupy a sovereign country, and so forth.
Tell us a little bit about that response that he made. Iraq, as we know, was plunged into chaos. Weapons of mass destruction was found to be a non-existent threat and largely kind of bolstered by people who were interested in promoting the invasion of Iraq. How does Ignatieff account for that in his Empire Light thesis?
Well, one of the things he does in his long, meandering, painful piece, which Linda McQuaig captured very well, describing Ignatieff's mea culpa on Iraq was long on mea and short on culpa. So even in this so-called apology, the solipsism of Ignatieff is very evident. It's all about him. And what he argues, even in this piece supposedly apologizing for his support for the war, is that the opponents of the war were right for the wrong reasons, and that the advocates of the war were wrong for the right reasons. So you see, Ignatieff's pragmatic assessment of post-war Iraq was clouded by his humanitarian idealism, whereas the anti-war movement and the vast majority of world public opinion, our vision was clouded by these. I think he almost dismisses it as conspiracy theory about the war being about oil and U.S. economic and military interests. He dismisses all of the reasons that people around the world were opposed to the war. It's just that we turned out to be right. And he more or less places the blame for that on the Iraqis themselves being unable to get along. You know, he didn't foresee that the Shia and the Sunni and the Kurds would be unable to hold it together and would descend into civil strife. So it's consistent with his thesis in Empire Light, because the reason states fail in his thesis is the people who live in these states in the third world. It's never about the imperial powers that have abused them and dominated them for decades or centuries. So in Iraq, it's really, in Ignatieff's view, it's the fault of the Iraqis for making good humanitarians like him look bad.
In addition to Empire Light, Ignatieff's written several other books which lay out his views. One of these books is Lesser Evil. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Yeah, it's a very ironic title given the current political situation, where we're often told Ignatieff is the lesser evil to Stephen Harper. And I'm not going to be an extremist here. Obviously, on certain issues of domestic policy, he is a liberal government would be a lesser evil. But that's a whole nother discussion of whether we want to have lesser evils. The book itself is an assertion that so-called Western liberal democracy is the lesser evil to terrorism and or Islamic fundamentalism, which, you know, are more or less conflated as being the same thing. And the book is a long justification for restrictions on civil liberties in the war on terror. It's very interesting. Again, it's that compass needle that bobbles around, because in the book, he documents the evidence historically that torture doesn't work. So he gives some historical examples. For instance, some of the founders of Al-Qaeda were originally radicalized when they were being tortured by the Egyptian regime. After Sadat's assassination, they were subjected to years of torture and came out as hardened militants. So he gives all this evidence, but then he goes on, because he's on the side of the empire, he's on the side of the so-called lesser evil, he goes on to justify the use of targeted assassination, rendition, so-called coercive interrogation, which, you know, as I think most people know, for instance, in the case of so-called waterboarding, it's torture. It's really water torture. So there's a semantic game that Ignatieff's involved in, just like the Bush administration was, saying we don't torture, but at the same time committing, engaging in practices that amount to torture, and all the other restrictions on civil liberties that we've seen over the last 7-8 years in the name of the war on terror.
Canada has a commitment in Afghanistan until 2011. If Ignatieff were to become prime minister, what kind of policy do you think he would pursue in Afghanistan?
On this one, we can pretty fairly say it would be identical to Stephen Harper, because we can just look at the record since Ignatieff has graced us with his return to Canada and his entry into formal politics in 2006 as a rookie MP, but, you know, nonetheless as a power broker within the Liberal Party. When Harper initially pushed through an extension of the war till 2009, he did so by splitting the Liberal Party, and he was only able to win the vote on the war with the support of Ignatieff and 24 other Liberal MPs. And after that vote in the House, Harper made a big show of walking across the aisle and shaking hands with Ignatieff to sort of show the maybe less pro-war wing of the Liberal Party where Ignatieff stood, and to really show their unity on that issue. And then again, obviously in March of last year, the entire Liberal Party voted with the Conservatives to extend the war to the end of 2011. You could make a case, if you were trying to be cheeky, that Harper is less pro the war in Afghanistan, because during the election campaign, he outflanked the Liberals by saying, hey, at the end of 2011, we're out of there. No more extensions of the war. Of course, there's no reason to trust either of the main parties in Canada. And certainly with the Obama administration now, there will be a big pressure on Canada to extend its presence in Afghanistan even beyond the end of 2011.
While at Harvard, Ignatieff on occasion referred to himself as an American. Do you think he hopes for closer ties with the U.S.?
Oh, he hopes for closer ties with wherever power lies. People often assume, partly because of that Ignatieff has spent the last 25 years in the States, but he spent 22 years in the U.K., in Britain. That's where most of his career has been. He spent 4 or 5 years in the United States, leaving in 2005. But as you say, nonetheless, very quickly beginning to write and speak publicly as an American. So, you know, you can research Ignatieff if you have a strong stomach on YouTube and look at some of his interviews. There's an interview of him in 2005 on the Charlie Rose Show, where he actually says he has sleepless nights now about Iraq because, you know, a part of him really thought we would be greeted as liberators in Iraq. So there he is, identifying fully, not just with the empire, but identifying as a citizen as an American would. So people should consider this when they think about him as our next prime minister, and just think about what that says about the personality of the man.
We've spoken mostly about Ignatieff and his views internationally and his ideas about empire or empire light. What about on domestic policy? What would we expect from Ignatieff if he were in power in Canada?
Sure. Again, if you look at his written record, he doesn't have a lot of interest in Canadian domestic issues because he hasn't been here. And his interests have been, you know, as a foreign correspondent, as a British public intellectual, and then, as we just said, you know, as a someone identifying with the American imperial project. So on domestic policy, you know, like a good liberal, he can probably go with the flow a little bit and be probably more flexible on economic issues, for instance, than the Harper administration has proven to be. You know, again, there are differences on things like same-sex marriage, abortion rights. I don't think his agenda goes as far as Harper in trying to roll back those rights. So one thing worth noting, though, is that, you know, with the toppling of Dion and the anointing of Ignatieff as leader, I think that was quite a strong signal from the business liberals, the Bay Street powers behind the liberal throne, that Dion had strayed too far to what they would view as the left. So in that sense, Ignatieff might represent more of the Paul Martin liberalism, more of the Bay Street liberals reasserting themselves. So he may, in that sense, be more closely aligned with the business elite in Canada.
Well, thank you very much for coming in this morning, Derek. It's been interesting. I think I felt like I've had my primer on Ignatieff, and there's lots to consider, and we'll keep our eye on him.
Certainly. Thank you for having me in this morning.
I've been speaking with Derek O'Keefe. He's the editor of Rabble.ca, and he is the co-chair of StopWar.ca.